Les conférences du Collège de France.
Good afternoon, everybody. It's 5:30, so I'm just going to start. What you see here is what I'm going to be talking about. It's a brand new book. This is what it looks like. French translation is currently being prepared, but it may still take a while to see things go. Just say something about my co-authors. Avner Greif is a professor emeritus at Stanford University and a graduate student of mine. And Guido Tabellini is former rector and now professor of economics and political economy at Bocconi University. We've been working on this book for about 6 years. It's finished now. What's done is done, so to speak. So let me try to spend the next hour, maybe a few minutes more, trying to summarize some parts of what is a 450-page book, so wish me luck. But I want to start, as I often do, with some historical context. And that is whether economic history is a tale of persistences or of reversals. So there's a whole literature now about persistence and pointing out that things that happened in the very remote past still predict things that are happening many centuries later or even today. And so you would sort of think that history is sort of what people call past dependent, right? So the past determines the future. But the problem is that things persist except when they don't. And that sort of makes the theory a little bit weaker because there is in history another phenomenon which we call reversals of future, of fortune, sorry, reversals of fortune. So things change. So for instance, there's a famous literature about how around 1600, the southern part of the American continent was much richer than the northern part. And of course, today it's the reverse. And so that's a reversal. I'm going to talk today about what I call the mother of all reversals. And that is that around the year 1000, what in Europe is now known as the Middle Ages, Europe was a poor, backward, and barbarous place, whereas the three great Asian civilizations, China, India, and the Muslim Middle East, were far more advanced. I'm going to try to show you some data about that, and then talk about one of these reversals, which is the reversal between Europe and China. And so a different way of looking at it is just asking, why is it Europe and not China that was the source of the Industrial Revolution and eventually what people call the Great Enrichment? So this has been known sometimes as the Great Divergence, following a book by Kenneth Pomerantz. But I actually think that the word divergence sort of seems to see that they start at a similar point and then go in different direction. But in fact, what you see is a reversal. You see, they're basically changing places. So by 1900, this seems to be without any doubt, okay? So ever since Needham, and of course Needham is the great British scholar who for the first time documented and described China's achievements in science and technology, but it's more than just Needham, it's almost everything. But if you think about, say, a whole bunch of variables, you can see this great reversal showing up over and over again. So if you look at, say, economists like to look at GDP per capita. I'm not a great fan of it over the very long run, but that's a different debate. Technological creativity, scientific progress, state capacity, urbanization, military capability, all of those variables we can in some ways measure. So all of these things, of course, when exactly the switch happens is, of course, debatable. And historians disagree, but let me just look here at, this is the data on income divergence. This is the data by Steve Broadbury, and of course the line to look at is the green one, which is China, and you can sort of see that from about year 1000, there's very little trend there. I mean, it goes up a little bit around 1650, but that's not so much because GDP went up, its population went down because of a major civil war. with the sort of Ming-Xing transition. But you can see that Europeans either are considerably richer there, as you can see in Italy, or when they're not, like the Great Britain and the Netherlands, at some point just overtake China by orders of magnitude. The rate of innovation in China, too, is declining. It is well known that around the year 1000, which is the time of the Song, not only the Song dynasty in China, China was an extremely inventive and innovative society. But at some point, and nobody's quite sure when, it starts to slow down and eventually vanishes. So the end of this Song dynasty is in 1279, with the beginning of the Yuan dynasty. Of course, it's then when Marco Polo shows up in China and sees all these wonders of China. But what he did not know is that basically he was seeing it at its peak, and after that it may have started going down. So there's one interesting statistic, and that is that a man called William Winchester, in a book about Needham, went through all the volumes of Science and Civilization in China, which is like 17 or 18 volumes here, were written by him and his students. And he sort of counted all the major inventions and innovations. And the striking thing is that very few of those appear before 1200 and none after 1500. And that, I think, and in some ways, in fact, we see technological retrogression in shipbuilding, in clockmaking, in other things. So this is the data by, this is a new set of data by, put together by Yasheng Huang at MIT. It does it by dynasty, which I find sort of less than helpful, but you can sort of see the trend going down just as much. This is a very different measure. This is state capacity. And economic historians have, rightly or wrongly, equated state capacity with economic progress. So the state, as a nation advances and becomes richer, the relative size of the state in terms of revenue and spending goes up. So this is sort of the Middle Ages, sort of somewhat, should say liberally. And you can see China in 1086, the state spends about 10% of GDP. Iraq, which is also an Asian civilization, this is 200 years earlier, of course, but still. But you can see that England and France, the amount of revenue taken in by the crown is essentially minimal. By 1800, leaving out Japan, which is a special case, you can sort of see that England and France, and even the United States, which is barely coming into its own, are way, way higher than China under the Qing dynasty, which is there in 1800. Here you have urbanization. So urbanization is widely regarded by economists as a reasonably good measure of economic development. And again, I wish there were enough data to give you a graph, but there aren't. These are very rough data, and they have all kind of measurement problems I'm not going to get into. But you can sort of see that, again, large towns in Europe in around 1,000 is essentially nil. By 1800, they are almost three times as many, larger proportion of population living in these large towns in Europe. And so why? So one sort of pithy way of showing this is calling this maps versus chaps. Okay, so maps is geography, and chaps is culture, society, institutions, well, roughly speaking. And so there is clearly a geographical component to the Great Reversal that we shouldn't neglect. So Ken Pomeranz and others have pointed to the fact that particularly Britain has a lot of coal. In China, there is coal, but it's in the wrong places, things like that. And also that Europe was able to colonize areas in the New World and elsewhere, which benefited them. Also, he doesn't tell us why Europe was capable of doing that and China doesn't, okay? The big thing is the third bullet here. And that is that China is, you know, from essentially 1279 on, a unified empire. And even before that, for much of its history, it is unified, at least since the Qin dynasty that came to power in 211 BC. Europe, after the decline of Rome is fragmented. And it is still fragmented, even so the European Union has sort of set that back a little bit. And so there's been a lot of literature about this, pointing out the advantages of Europe being fragmented versus China being unified and not really having to compete with any other nations. The most prominent scholars here are Walter Scheidel in his big fat book called After Rome. Eric Jones was way ahead of everybody else 40 years ago. But if you look carefully, you see that even in the 18th century, people like David Hume and Immanuel Kant and Edward Gibbons all talk about this and basically say, look, the fact that Europe is fragmented is a good thing because they compete with each other. And of course, for an economist, competition, you know, that immediately rings a bell. And so recently, there's been a fair amount of literature pointing out that, in fact, that fragmentation itself may be driven to some extent by geography. There's an excellent paper published in the Quarterly Journal of Economics that points this out. Of course, a lot of literature deals with the CHAPS part. All kinds of people with different views. Needham himself, of course, Nathan Thiewin, David Landes, Derek Boddy, you know, Justin Lin. These are economists, historians, sociology, anthropologists, and other people all writing about this subject. Some of them blame the state. Some of them blame Confucianism and its new version, Neo-Confucianism, and basically Chinese conservative attitudes emerging at that time. Most recently, political economists have gotten into debate. So here are two brand new books, one by Yaxing Huang, who I already mentioned, and the other by Yuhua Wang. And these are, you know, scholars working in the United States, by the way, but obviously knowing the Chinese literature. And they have come up with a variety of political arguments explaining what went wrong in China. The other sort of philosophical thing, this is also a professor at Harvard, Peter Ball, and essentially argued that Neo-Confucianism, not Confucianism itself, but Neo-Confucianism that was formulated and came to power in the sort of closing century of the Song Dynasty and so on, particularly the work by a man called Zhu Xi, who probably was the most influential philosopher in China, this side of Confucius. And so essentially in this system, some of the characteristics that he points out may not have been conducive to a very dynamic economy, sort of filial loyalty, strict gender hierarchy, and strongly emphasizing ancestor worship that I will talk about a little bit later today. So where does our book stand? Okay, so our book stands firmly in the CHAPS camp, but it proposes a new approach, which doesn't mean that we are just throwing out the MAPS interpretation, and we argue in the book in some detail that the two sort of groups of factors actually may be reinforcing each other. But we are taking a different approach. And this different approach focuses on something which we call social organizations. So this is not the same as the state. Many of these social organizations we could think of as sort of non-state organizations. But what you need to have in every human society in the past are bodies that coordinate and organize the production of what we call local public goods or club goods, which are very similar. And these are essential to economic and social life. Now, in our own time, most of these public goods are provided by the state. And so they're no longer local, so some of them are provided by local authorities, obviously, but the most important ones are provided by a centralized or federal state. And there are things like justice, conflict resolution, defense, of course, agricultural coordination, insurance, poor relief, religious services, education, all the sort of things that make society work, but that require at some level coordination and cooperation between individuals. So no single household can provide these things on its own, which is why they are public goods, so to speak. Now, in the past, precisely because the state was so insignificant, as I showed you, it's almost all local. I mean, there's a little bit of defense here and there. And here and there, in particular in England, you can see some royal justices, but it's a teeny tiny thing. Almost everything is done at the local level, in part because transportation, of course, is very costly and very, very awkward. Okay? In that sense, this is a thing that we need to focus on. And so how is this cooperation achieved? And cooperation is not a trivial thing to achieve. Economists who have been doing game theory now for half a century, of course, know this. There's always danger of people, of what we know collective action problems. So if somebody is a free rider, and if somebody sees somebody who's not a free rider sees a free rider, he says, "Oh, I'm going to be a free rider too," and so on. This spreads, and the whole thing could unravel. So you need to have cooperation that takes care of the problem of opportunistic behavior. And so much of the world before, say, the 1000, and for much of it after it, that cooperation is provided by extended families. Or you can call them tribes, or we will refer to them as clans. But basically, it's a group of people who share a common ancestor. Basically, that's what it is. It could be a village, although within that village, usually there are a lot of people who share common ancestors as well. And a cooperation in a group like that works. Why? Because the interaction is repeated. These are fairly small groups of people, maybe a few hundred, maybe a few thousand, but most of them, at least those who mattered, knew each other, and they interact at many levels. And so we know that in such games, cooperative equilibria can emerge and persist. In fact, if you look at the last bullet, if the game is repeated infinitely, which is an approximation, of course, and the future is not too heavily discounted, which it may or may not have been, a folk theorem in game theory suggests that cooperation is an equilibrium, meaning a sustainable outcome. And what you have to have is that if the group is small enough and somebody behaves opportunistically, everybody knows who he is. And so we can punish him. And if you don't punish him, you yourself will be punished. And that actually can create an equilibrium, provided the group is not too large and some other conditions hold. The important thing is that, and what keeps it together, is that the clan, the family, does not have an exit option. So if you're a member of a family, and everybody in this room would know this, there may be days in which you'd like to exit your extended family and miss one bar mitzvah or something, but you can't. It's family, it's genetically determined. Everybody knows who your cousins and your nephews and your uncles are, so to speak. But if there's no exit, that means the punishment can be harsher. It can be, take place at many levels, right? So if you cheat somebody in an economic transaction, you may be ostracized personally, not being invited to my wedding, things like that. And so if everybody knows that, this is common knowledge, the incentive to cheat will be fairly small. So this is actually a system that works. And it worked in most societies. And so what the book argues is that somewhere, sometime after 1000, you get the great bifurcation in social organizations. And that China, because the imperial government is weakening, more and more commits to social organization by clan. And in Europe, exactly the reverse happens. Extended families are gradually using their role as the core of units of organizations. And this has to do with something I will talk about a little bit, which is that the entire institutional marriage in Europe becomes different and becomes very special. This is known as the European marriage pattern, or the EMP, I will talk about. And the argument of the book is that this development, which was completely sort of an emergent property, in fact, that nobody actually knew what this was going to do, but once it's there, it has consequences that nobody anticipated and nobody intended. That, I think, is the way to think about this. So let me talk briefly about what's happening in China and then come back and talk about what's happening in Europe. So during the Song Dynasty, between 960 and 1279, the growth of clans and the imperial bureaucracy, or it's known sometimes as the mandarins, also mandarins is not a Chinese word, created some kind of a symbiotic relationship in which local clans in various places collaborated with the Chinese imperial bureaucrats that were sent there for usually for a limited time, and together produced these local public goods and club goods. And so clans in China increasingly became the organizations that supplied what I said that these organizations do. Education, insurance, poor relief, local defense, conflict resolution, and even infrastructural investment, particularly, of course, hydraulic investments, which is typically the big issue in with irrigation or flood control. When this precisely happens depends but where you are and what the sources are that you're using. I think there is a consensus that, A, by about 1500, it's essentially complete. And first, that it was more pronounced in the rice-growing areas in the south of China than in the wheat-growing areas of the north, but that eventually it extended everywhere. Now, it's fair to say that clans were never the only body that provided public goods. There was always some input of the imperial government. But as the imperial government gets weaker and weaker, the part that they do is less and less, and there's more and more independence of the clans. So there is a big literature here, and I'm going to citing it. And of course, the interesting thing is that you can see these organizations emerging hand in hand with radical cultural changes. And that, I think, is an important thing. So the growth of the extended family is perfectly consistent with the growth of a Neo-Confucian-based culture of loyalty to one's kin that I described earlier and that we learned from Peter Bull and other historians. Okay, so here's a quote from Peter. So no Neo-Confucians, on the family, the kinship-based ritual unit that could serve as the building block of local society. And I think that is a very good summary of what we are arguing as well. But that tends to correlate with other things that have maybe have very deep implications. There's a fairly large literature, summarized, by the way, by this book by Joe Hendrick, in 2020, which I believe is translated into French. Joe is a psychological anthropologist, I would say, not an economist, but he knows a lot of economics. But essentially, what he argues, and large literature has argued, that people who grow up in extended families are people who are different from people who are growing up in nuclear families, that they people prove that mostly by contemporary societies by having played little games, so like the dictator game and the public good game and these various games that try to see how cooperative you are. And it turns out that people who are growing up in nuclear families consistently are more cooperative and more public-minded and more civic-minded than people who grow up extended families, provided they deal with people that they don't know. So a lot of this has to do with people, how you deal with strangers that you don't know. So here's the difference between the two. This is by Ben Enke, who's a professor at Harvard. He says, a communitarian like somebody growing up in a clan, is a great friend to have, whereas a universalist is a great stranger to encounter. And of course, modern economies are entirely almost entirely interactions between strangers, between people who are not your relatives. That, I think, is a critical thing. So, as I said, you know, there's a whole bunch of things that Hendrik and others have shown about the difference between people growing up in these societies. And so here are some more basic stylized facts about the Chinese clans. There's a lot of footnotes and a lot of details in the book. As I said, they actually can be seen to have existed before the Song Dynasty in 960, but they're mostly among sort of elite and land-owning, and it sort of, you know, filters down to the masses later on. They tend to be correlated with the Great Migration. So one of the things in China, which I'm not going to talk about now, is that during the Song Dynasty, there was a massive migration from the northern provinces to the south of China, associated with invasions of Mongols and other people in the north, and with the cultivation of a superior variety of rice in the south, which increased harvest. And so the formation of clans is actually, in most cases at least, encouraged by the imperial government. So here you have a footnote here. This is the so-called Lijia reform, just to pick one example. This was passed in 1370 by the Hongwu Emperor, who was the first emperor of the Ming Dynasty, and basically granted these lineage heads, meaning the head of the large family, known as Zhuzhang, authoritative status, and identified the role as presiding over the ancestral rites, which of course had all kinds of other non-religious implications as well. So it made this decree, you know, I would say, formalized. The clan is the main provider of local public goods in China, with, of course, imperial supervision, he was hoping. So this historical evolution is well understood. It started off as the prayer association, but then it took upon it more and more other responsibilities. And as I said, the sort of Bible, if I may use that term, or the gospel of this, is this man, Zhu Qi. This is a translation. It's still the older Latinization of Chinese words, but this is Zhu Qi. And this is, I'm not sure you can read this, a 12th century Chinese manual for the performance of cappings, weddings, funerals, and ancestral rites. So this is essentially part of this sort of public good provision that clans do at the time of Zhu Qi, and then it expands into many other things over and over again. So this is just what I just said. So it, and how does this then compare with what's happening in Europe? Roughly speaking, at the same time. So Europe sees over the longer period that we today refer to as the Middle Ages, the emergence of the nuclear family as the fundamental social building block of society. So these are known as sometimes as conjugal families, and on and on and on. And this is known, as I said, as the European marriage pattern. So where is this happening? This was first pointed out in a famous article by a man called John Haynal, and is now known as the Haynal line. So here you have the Haynal line. It's this sort of green line that runs, roughly speaking, between St. Petersburg and Trieste. And everything to the west of it is subject to the European marriage pattern. When you go to the right, which is, you know, mostly Russia and the Balkan, much less so. So that was the sort of observation that Haynal made at the time, and I don't think anybody really still contests it. So what is the European marriage pattern? Well, there's a whole bunch of characteristics that all form, essentially help to create the nuclear family. The first is that marriage is relatively late. Women married in Europe, as far as we can tell, and you know, the data don't get very good when you go into the earlier Middle Ages, but it's typically everywhere in the world, women got married at when they reached menarche, that is to say they became fertile. And that would be, at that time, around 16. In Europe, when we first start getting hard data, women married at age 22, 23. So you chop off a quarter of the fertile span of women right there and then. Neolocality, that's an important thing. When a couple gets married, they do not move in, not with her parents and not with his parents. They form a new household. That was the rule which very few was violated. Monogamy, that too is a very European kind of characteristic. Now, China has a somewhat ambiguous thing with monogamy. Of course, the Middle East does not. No divorce, completely disallowed. Marriage can be annulled by the Pope for certain reasons. You remember Henry VIII is famous, you know. But basically no divorce in Europe until the modern times. High rates of celibacy. A considerable proportion of the population never gets married at all. Not just nuns and monks, although they, of course, by definition, weren't married, but also other people who, for one reason or another, did not marry. That, too, is very rare in other society. No consanguineous marriages, so you cannot marry relatives. Not just that you can marry your sister and your brother. That's almost nowhere happening. But cousins, second cousins, third cousins, all the way to fifth cousins. I don't know how this was enforced. I have no idea who my fifth cousins are. Maybe anybody here does. I don't know. But you can marry them. So how would that work? Well, there are no population records, but there are snitches. So if you live in a village and a couple gets married and you go and say, oh, no, this marriage is invalid because they are fourth cousins, you had a good chance of these people being their property being confiscated, and you get a part of it. So this is, you know, this is more enforceable than you think. No adoption, by the way, very different from Rome, where adoption of children was very normal. No levirate and sororate. I mean, you don't have to worry about that. It means basically that it's a biblical thing that if the husband dies and his brother is unmarried, then it's his job to marry the widow. I think it's probably rare. Discourage remarriage, not successfully, I believe. And finally, and this is actually important, consensuality of marriage. So in Europe, unlike any society that I know of at the time, when a wedding takes place, the woman gets asked, do you want to marry this guy? Now, whether she had the option of saying no, who knows? But at least she's asked, which was not true in Islamic society, it was not true in India, it was not true in China. Basically, it was you're told, you know, by her father or a guardian or a brother, okay, so today you are marrying so-and-so, okay, that's it, goodbye. Not in Europe. So this is sort of interesting. One of the implications of that consensuality, it has been argued, is that it treated women relative, at least to other societies, as more as equals. Not quite equals, I mean, this is still the Middle Ages, but there's a paper written about this called Girl Power, meaning that women had more bargaining power than men in a variety of things. As I said, later marriage, lower marriage rates, and therefore lower overall fertility. So in a standard Malthusian model, that will actually imply that income per capita is higher. But most relevant, I think, to our point is that this created a world of individualistic nuclear family consisting of husband, wife, and children. And when the children grew up and got married, they moved out. So, maybe brief digression, why? Why does this happen? And so, a lot of this clearly is related to the policies of the church. And Joe Hendrick refers to it as somewhat, I think, with stretch. It's called the accidental genius of the church, as if the church would know that this would lead to all these other outcomes, which, of course, is more accidental than genius, but never mind that. But there are economic arguments as well. Europe, which is an agricultural society, like all societies at the time, has almost everybody has livestock. More than any other agriculture, European agriculture depends on a sort of the symbiosis of animals and arable crops. Don't get me talking about why. But what is clear is women have a comparative advantage in tending livestock because taking care of pigs or goats or sheep or cows, there's no advantage to upper body strength, whereas in collecting the harvest there is. And so so women tended to deal with animals, and that gave them perhaps more bargaining power and also the capability of making some money before she got married so that they could buy a place, she and her husband. This got particularly pronounced after the Black Death in 1348, but I think it probably was already going on long before. There are other arguments, one of also related to this, which is that, of course, that a very large lineage cannot be bilinear. It has to be patriarchal. Why? Because if it's bilineal, the number of ancestors explodes after three or four generations, because you have not only your cousins and your uncles and your aunts on your mother's side, you also have them on your father's side. In China, you could do that because everything is patriarchal. In Europe, because lineage is always measured on both parents, it's sort of hard to see how an ancestor-based society could work. But the big argument was made by Jack Goody many years ago. He's in British anthropology. And he said, the question is cui bono, who gained from this? And the answer is the church. How come? Well, Jack calculated that if the authorities, this is in his book, if the authorities prohibit marriage among relatives and ban adoption and discourage remarriage and divorce, 40% of all marriages will be left without an immediate male heir. And that, when what happens is, who gets the possessions of that family? The answer is the church, in most cases. So for the church to discourage clans and focus on the nuclear families and putting all these constraints means that they could accumulate enormous amounts of land and property, which they do. Now, Henry VIII knew that too, so there's a risk there, but in many places that is what, of course, happened. There's also, I think, an element of ideology. This has been argued by historians. It's very hard to prove it, but there's a very strong feeling of that what they call incestuous behavior, that it is a sin. And medieval Europe is a society which people think about sin all the time. We don't, thank God. But that's what it is. So now, here is the dilemma that this society must have faced. Also, I'm not sure anybody actually knew it, but this is all sort of implicit. The nuclear family is too small to provide local public goods. You need a larger group. So what you need is social organizations that overcame the collective action problem and enabled the supply of club and local public goods. And so what you need are organizations in which people make a credible commitment not to behave opportunistically and cheat, and some framework to punish cheaters. And the genius of Europe, or the luck of Europe, depending on your point of view, and I'm not particularly committed to one way or another, is that they came up with an organization which we call corporations. Now, this is not, of course, corporations in the modern sense, like Exxon or General Motors. This is a different kind of corporation. The term was coined by Avner Greif here in these two papers, and it sort of stuck. But in some ways, it's confusing. But here is the thing. Corporations are social organizations that are voluntary. You're not born into them, you join them. So it's different from clan. They are interest-based, so they're not, serving everything. They're serving a particular purpose, or at least a set of related purposes. They are self-governing, much like clans in that regard. And they're intentionally created So if we are going to set up a social organization that will do what we want it to do. It is not established by the state. It sometimes collaborates with the state. Sometimes it fights the state. But corporations had to cater to their members' interests, and there was an exit option, unlike, as I said earlier, the Klan. And so, you know, they had other legal status. For instance, they are formal and permanent entities. They can sue. They cannot. They can be sued, and so on and so forth. And so here's what they are: unrelated people, infinite horizon, sharply delineated binary membership. So you're either a membership of this organization or you're not. And you can be a member of many organizations. Yeah, not too many, but you don't. A clan, you basically, this is your clan and that's it, right? You're a member of that clan or not. You cannot be a member of two clans, but you can be a member of two corporations. So what kind of things do we have? And I'll give you a list of these corporations in a minute. But you can sort of see that this is what we call in systems analysis an emergent property. People get together and say, hey, you know what, maybe we should do this, take care of this hydraulic problem that is particularly big in the Netherlands together. And so, fine, they cooperate and they come up with rules how to punish cheaters and so on and so forth, and they come up with some cooperative equilibrium. Nobody is thinking that this is going to have deep, enormous consequences deep into the future, okay? And so local action will have unintended, unanticipated global consequences. That is essentially the argument. So here are a list of these corporations. There's more, but these are the most important ones. So monasteries is one of them. Very important, of course, in medieval Europe. Universities, founded as corporations. Guilds, both merchant and craft guilds. Merchant guild came earlier. Fraternities, which are organizations of people who celebrate things together or cooperate in other ways. Militias, mostly for local defense. Village councils to coordinate agricultural activity. And maybe most important, urban corporations. We actually call it a corporation. Basically, autonomous cities and what is known as communes. So these are self-governing cities. And either you are a citoyen, you are a citizen of this city, or you're not, right? It's completely binary. And if you don't like the city, and lots of people didn't, you go to another city. And so the main argument of the book, then, is that this difference between corporations of unrelated people in Europe and clans of people who are related to China affected the great divergence in many ways. So I'm not going to have time to go through all of these because I want to leave some time for questions. But I want to point out that in the end, this has enormous impacts, not just on the economy, but also on political and religious organizations in Europe. So in China, as we said, there is growing symbiosis between Chinese imperial bureaucracy and leaders of the local clans. And in Europe, one of the things that we see emerging is a rise of what you may perhaps best call participatory government. I don't want to call it democracy because it really isn't democracy by our standards, but it is still a case in which citizens can be heard on what kind of people they want to be ruled by. Okay, so this is true in a guild where the guild leaders are being elected by the members. It's true for monasteries, it's true in cities. All of those, a group of people, maybe not everybody, certainly not women, I must say, but and not Jews, but regular citizens could have an input in who was going to lead them and what kind of decisions were going to be made. And one of the things that we argue at great length in the book, I'm not going to get into it for lack of time, is that many of the practices and the customs that were established in these corporations, these smaller local organizations, then essentially percolated up to state organizations. So this gives you an immediate explanation why there never was any democracy in China. Not before, during the Imperial China, not after the revolution, not today. There is no. It's not to say that Chinese culture is completely inconsistent with democracy. We can see that some Chinese societies seem to be working with it, like in Taiwan, for instance, but not there. Anyway, so the one more thing that I think is important and I would like to emphasize is, so these are these percolated up to the states. I'm not going to get through this. These are various principles that emerged in medieval Europe, plena potestas. We have quod omnes tangit. Quod omnes tangit may be worth pointing out what it is. It's essentially no taxation without representation, you know. Quod omnes tangit, whatever touches all. So whatever touches all basically says that the executive authority cannot act without the consent of a consultative body. And what that really tells you is that if the king wants to do a particular step, like go to war, impose a tax, you know, he has to consult somebody. So in England, it's the parliament. Here in France, it's the Etats Généraux. Every country has some kind of representative bodies there. Voting becomes a problem, of course, in those cases. And you can sort of, for the first time, see actually people worrying about voting paradoxes and the mathematics of voting, which is a fun field that political scientists do, started all the way in the 13th century with a Catalan called Ramon Llull. And then, of course, most of the great thinkers about it were French, Condorcet, Bourdin, Laplace, among others. And, of course, an economist, Kenneth Arrow, in the 20th century. Voting becomes an issue as a result of the problem of voting in these corporations. But here you have a whole list of these parliaments that start meeting in Europe. You think that I mentioned these already. The same in Poland, the Cortes, and Iberia. I mean, you see them basically everywhere. This is not an accident. And we argued, and we showed this in detail, how this is mapped from the behavior of corporations to the higher authorities. All right, so I mean, I shall just move on. In China, it moves in exactly the opposite direction, just as you would perhaps expect. Unlike in medieval Europe, Chinese culture increasingly emphasized the primacy of the collective and did not bother to ask the individual. But more important, perhaps, is people don't have right. In Europe, in medieval, almost everywhere, individuals have certain rights. Okay, they include not to be taxed without some form of consent, but also, for instance, property rights. You know, what you own, the state cannot, at least in theory, take. It sometimes did, but then you usually get yourself in trouble. The other thing which I want to come back to is ancestor worship. Because Europe abandons its extended family, you know, ancestor worship cannot take place. You don't see any ancestor worship in Europe anywhere that I know of. You see saint worship, but these saints are not your ancestor. They're somebody who did something remarkable. In China, there is ancestor worship. And what's more, there is, and I'll come back to that, intellectual ancestor worship. So here is a great political scientist, Feiner, who describes, I think, the five tenets of Chinese culture. When he says ancient, I really mean all the way till 1912. Collective and mutual responsibility, not individualism. Authoritarianism, paternalism, and absolutism, not self-determination. Inequality and hierarchy, not at least theoretical equality before the law. Now, equality before the law, we have a long section about that. in Europe. Of course, it's more de jure than de facto, and certainly here in France, part, that was part of the reason the revolution erupted in 1789. But at least in theory, there is a sense that everybody is equal before God and everybody should be equal before the law. People in China are subjects. In Europe, they are citizens. Now, what that precisely implies depends a bit on who's in power and so on and so forth, but at least the theory is there. And in China, people have duties. In Europe, they have rights. I mean, again, one could debate this, but perhaps the most important is that the result of this is that in China, people are ruled by law. The law gives the emperor the power to do whatever basically the emperor wants to do. In Europe, it's ruled off law. And we still hear that term, certainly in the country I live in, rule of law being endangered, but it's considered to be, you know, one of the theoretical pillars of the state. And of course, the culture evolves with these institutions. And this is particularly true in China, where, as I said, Neo-Confucianism encouraged the emergence of a highly educated professional bureaucracy. And the idea is perhaps that education rather than coercion should be used to rule people. I must say, you look at Chinese history and you say, look, the theory is that good government is government by scholarly good man, right? So this is essentially the essence of Confucianism, not of laws. Whereas in Europe, I think the notion is it's laws, not of good men, because not all men are good. And they weren't very good in China either. And so corruption becomes much more endemic and deeply socially acceptable than it is in Europe. And in China, I would say the paradox is that clans and absolutism reinforce each other as the state, the imperial bureaucracy, becomes weaker over time. And so this is, I already mentioned this, the Li Jia tax system, but particularly, I think, under the Qing dynasty, which comes to power in 1644, this becomes very pronounced. And China becomes a very absolutist country in which the emperor has essentially no constraints on his power. And yet the state can do less and less. Now, we would say in economics, that was not an equilibrium. All right. So I'm going to skip much of this for the purpose of time. So this is, by the way, I wanted to show you this. This is Joe Hendrick's book. You know, I would not have chosen that title, I must say. But, you know, it is a brilliant book, and it actually is loaded with insight, so I recommend it. But what, in the end, you get, and this is something that I have already said, but I want to stress it, is that in Europe, we have more and more what we call universalistic values, okay? Which is a social hierarchy based on a contractual reciprocity, generalized values, and individualism writing from the Middle Ages on. Whereas in China, we have more and more what's known as communitarian values, in which you are perfectly a member of your clan, and everybody else essentially is somebody you don't want to deal with and have great difficulty solving problems with. That, I think, is a central point needed to understand China's. There are three, to repeat, components. Clan system, an imperial state bureaucracy run by scholar officials, and this Neo-Confucian set of collectivist beliefs. All right, so now to summarize. Europe and China were different, okay? And these are the ways they are different. One small question. So what? And so what I'm going to argue in maybe the next 10, 15 minutes before I open this up is that this actually is a key to understanding why an industrial revolution happened in Europe and not in China. Now, most of the economic gap, as at least measured by GDP, between China and Europe occurs after 1750. You could, if you remember the curve I showed you earlier. It's there before. I don't really subscribe to the fact that everything happened only in 1750, which is what Pomerantz and others believe. But I want to argue that the bifurcation of social organizations related to the Industrial Revolution. And so I'm going to provide five linkages. And I'm going to spend a few minutes on each. The book has 20, 25 pages on each. First is intellectual ancestor worship. As I said, intellectual ancestor worship is common throughout the world. People think that the wisdom was revealed to earlier generations. I said, talked about this last week. But in China in particular, because ancestor worship is already ingrained in people, they maintain a deep respect for the writings of earlier generations. And that, of course, is the arch enemy of radical innovations. Now, in Europe, in large part because of the way it is socially structured, the respect for classical science, which had still permeated much of the Middle Ages, starts to slowly evaporate. Now, it takes a good 200 years until this game is over. Okay, this is what becomes, of course, in France, what is known as the querelle des anciens et des modernes. But it's really all over. It's not just true in France. And so, as I argued that ancestor worship in China is holding back economic development, there's a recent paper by Chi-Chen Ma, which actually looked at shrines for ancestors and shows that in these areas there was less industrialization, less railroads, and less technological progress. I must also say, since I talked about intellectual ancestor worship, that my own forefathers, which is the European Jews, were probably the worst of all in terms of the respect that they had for the writings of earlier generations. It is still a centerpiece of Judaism, of at least Orthodox belief of, say there's a dictum of Chazal, which is essentially earlier sages, that says this, and this is a very good description of intellectual ancestor worship. It says, if those who were before us were like angels, we are but men. And if those who were before us were like men, we are like asses. Okay, that's in the Mishnah. And that, I think, is fairly representative of what Jews tended to believe until about the beginning of the Jewish Enlightenment in the late 18th century. And that, of course, is a very different story. But the rest of Europe abandoned this much earlier. You can see it beginning, I would say, in 1450. All of those classical authorities and many others, of course, were eventually biting the dust and shown to be completely wrong. And so this intellectual worship disappears. And that, I think, is a huge step forward. Because as long as you think that all the wisdom is revealed to our ancestors, you're not going to have any progress. Because anybody who comes up with a radical new idea is a heretic. And a heretic is a bad person in almost every society that I know of. The one Jew, this is a footnote, the one Jew that in this period became a radical innovator was Spinoza. But Spinoza was kicked out of the Jewish community in Amsterdam when he was 20. Nobody was allowed to talk to him. Nobody was allowed to eat with him. He was completely ostracized. He didn't give a damn, by the way. That's a different matter. Secondly, a corporation of intellectuals. This is something which I have written about earlier in my 2015 book. What I'm talking about here is connection between people who did not know each other, and in fact may never have met in the flesh. Remember, the transportation was so difficult at the time. But they kept in touch by mail. They read each other's books. They read each other's pamphlets. And they assessed the quality of scientific work. This is the Repubblica Literaria, or the Republic of Letters in Europe. And it's a complete, you know, virtual organization of people who did not know each other at all, but who had been, in some sense, socialized to deal with strangers. Now, is the Republic of Letters a corporation? Well, I've struggled with that question a long time. In the strict sense that I have defined it here, it's not. Because membership in most corporations was binary, it was sharply defined, it was formal, and that's not the case with the Republic of Letters. Basically, anybody could say, I'm a citizen of the Republic of Letters, and you know, there's no way of proving it. But it has many characteristics of a corporation, right? It's independent of the political structure. It is an association of like-minded people who were there to advance knowledge in a particular field. It set rules, even though they were not quite as enforceable as the rules of a monastery or a guild. It set rules, and the rules were, for instance, priority rights. If I'm the first one to discover something, I get associated with it. And so if you're Galileo, or if you're Kepler, or if you're Newton, everybody knew that you were the first to come up with that, okay? And eventually, of course, some of it becomes incorporated in actual corporations, particularly universities, not as much as I would have liked, but still scientific academies and the like. Rule number three, some corporations, of course, were themselves the source of intellectual and technological innovation. And as I said, the universities first come to mind. And you know, having been employed by a university for 52 years, it would really be nice if I could go to my students and say, yeah, you know, this kind of institution I worked for really drove the Industrial Revolution and economic progress. But it ain't true, ladies and gentlemen. Most universities were conservative and pushed back on novel ideas. And professors who taught things that were considered to be heretical could get themselves into trouble, could get fined or expelled. However, because there are so many of these corporations, and because they're all independent of each other and independent of the government, there's always one or two where there's a lot of activity going on, right? So for many years, for instance, the University of Padua was the most innovative university in Europe. And then when Padua declines, other places arise, like Leiden in the Netherlands. And later in the 18th century, particularly the Scottish University, Edinburgh and Glasgow, places like that. So there's always some places where there's activity going on, even if they're a very small minority, but progress is being made somewhere. Now, of course, there are other corporations that do this because the universities are so conservative, and these are what's known as scientific societies and academies, which we see spreading all over Europe in the 17th and 18th century. And the important thing, and this is something I've written about many times, is what these organizations do is they combine people who make things with people who know things. This is what the French call the sort of fabricant and the savant. So people get together and they talk about technical problems. And you get industrialists and natural philosophers coming together. The most famous of these is, of course, the Lunar Society in Birmingham in England, but there are many others all over Europe. In China, it is exactly the opposite. There is almost no interaction between people who are philosophers or learned and people who are making things, because learning is almost entirely channeled towards studying for the imperial examination or the Keijuu examination, which is right down here. And the curriculum for the Keijo examination consists certainly after 1500 almost entirely of Neo-Confucian theology and philosophy. And so you're not going to learn math or botany or physics or chemistry or mechanics in any of these Chinese academies. So, surprise, surprise, China is becoming more conservative. If it never produces an Isaac Newton or a René Descartes, or for that matter, a Martin Luther. There are many brilliant scientists, particularly at an earlier time, and some of them were truly amazing polymaths who did almost anything, but the Chinese system could not produce what I would say heterodox intellectuals, such as these and many other people. Another organization that as I think of as a corporation are autonomous cities. And many of these cities were so autonomous that basically they could do whatever they wanted. So if in a particular region, say, a book was placed on the index, right? So on the list of prohibited books, you could always find a place where these things could be printed, right? Amsterdam was a famous one, Rotterdam was one, but also Basel, Prague, Strasbourg, Edinburgh, there was always some place where you could go to, where you could live, where you could be respected, okay? So the famous French philosopher Pierre Bayle, who actually wrote a newspaper called Nouvelle de la République Littéraire, lived in Rotterdam. Well, in France he might have been arrested, but he could go to Rotterdam, which wasn't all that far, so he stayed there. There's nothing like this in China. And of course, monasteries, just to mention, in the Middle Ages at least, the monasteries were the place where science and technology was mostly practiced, in part because these were, practically speaking, the vast majority of people who were just literate. But the story about monastery is sort of hard to maintain, and I'm not maintaining it, because of course the monastery gets dissolved in England in 1538, and England is the place where the Industrial Revolution started. So linking the monastery to the Industrial Revolution is a bit of a stretch, although I should say it has been tried by economic historians. So there. Okay, then more cultural things. Two more, be very brief. One is that I think the kind of culture that nuclear families created creates a society in which people were more trusting of each other. In fact, that's one of the findings of Joe Hendrick, and they're trusting people who are to whom they're not related. Yeah, it's easy to trust your cousin if you're meeting him every day, but will you meet somebody that works for you, that is your partner, that lends you money or that borrows money from you? And so what has happened in England is, and we see this happening in the 18th century, and there have been some wonderful books written about this, is that the amount of trust of strangers is increasingly part of society. So there's a wonderful book by a guy called Sunderland there. In order to have something like an Industrial Revolution happen, you need to trust these people. So think about the most famous partnership of the Industrial Revolution. Matthew Boulton and James Watt, okay? Together they built a factory in Soho that produced Britain with steam power. Now these people didn't know each other. Okay? And Boulton was an Englishman, Watt was a Scotchman. But they got together, they trusted each other, and it worked perfectly well. And what's more, they had a bunch of senior engineers working for them who did most of the hard work, and they trusted them too. It's a society in which people who were not related got along and got along well. And so there's a fair amount of literature about this. And so the thing that I think drove all this is reputation. That if it were became known in Britain that you are not a gentleman, okay, then not only that nobody would lend you money, nobody would work for you, nobody would buy your stuff, and on and on and on, because this person is not a gentleman. Now, of course, if you know that, there's a strong incentive not to behave opportunistically, not to cheat. Now, did disagreements occur? Of course they did. And for that, you could, if you had to, go to court. But interestingly enough, the number of court cases goes down as economic activity goes up. Instead, people went to arbitration. They went to a third person that the disputant trusted and said, you tell us who's right. And it worked. And so that is what I call not a civil society, but a civil economy. All right, so finally, and this is my final point, the kind of trust relation that occurs between partners or between customers or between suppliers or, you know, whatnot, also exists in the most important, crucial contractual relationship in the Industrial Revolution. And that is the relationship between master and apprentice. I talked about that a little bit last week. Essentially, what that contract demands is it's almost always between strangers, okay? In some cases in which people were trained by their fathers, you know, mostly musicians, you know, like the Scarlattis and the Bachs. But I think in most artisanal groups, that was a fairly rare phenomenon. You went to somebody who was the best, or if you were poor, who was the cheapest, you know, but you chose somebody not necessarily related to you. How could you trust him? Well, there's a contract. That contract is a completely incomplete, if I may say so, a completely incomplete contract, clearly. It just says the apprentice will behave well, show up for work, not show up drunk, not chase women, and the master will teach him the details of, you know, baking or shoemaking or whatnot, okay? That's it, that's the contract. Well, you know, there's nothing there. I mean, what are the details? Well, if you had to write down the details, you had to explain how you bake bread with the contract, which is, of course, not realistic. And so this is the kind of thing that happens all over Europe. And one of the things which I'm finding very hard to prove, but I sense is right, is that between 1500 and 1750, there is an overall phenomenon in which the Europeans become more skilled and eventually become more skilled than other civilizations, okay? At 1500, that is decidedly not the case, right? Because Europeans were in part sailing around the Cape into Asia in order to get the products of Asian skills, you know, ceramics and silks in particular, but many other products as well. You have Persian rugs, Indian cottons, and so on and so forth. And of course, eventually, they all learned to make these things themselves. First, almost as good, then as good, and then better. That, I think, is... So you can see these things changing. There's a whole areas in which European were getting better. Mechanical skills as well. But for instance, optical instruments. Okay, the Europeans invented the microscope and they invented a telescope. Useful in some purposes. Mechanical clocks, da-da-da-da-da. By 1800, I think that gap has been reversed. And the first time the Asians, of course, learn how bad it is in 1839 with the first Opium War, when the British Navy blows away the Chinese Navy in a very asymmetrical war. So my argument essentially is that indirectly the link between these demographic changes in which Europe got committed to the nuclear family created unintended and unanticipated a higher level of skill. That, I think, is one way to think about this. So I'm going to conclude, and that's it. The great divergence in GDP and living standards may have been a fairly recent phenomenon. I think by 1750, I'm not sure that your average European, ate a lot better or lived in better conditions than the average Chinese. And then all of a sudden, you see this, what Ken Pomerantz called the divergence. But the roots go back to the early Middle Ages, when social organizations start to move in different directions, and with them, the provision of local public goods and the culture that is implied. So one way to think about it is this. The Industrial Revolution is not the cause of the great divergence, but an unintended and unanticipated consequence of much deeper an earlier historical forces. It was not the beginning of the great divergence, ladies and gentlemen, but its culmination. Thank you.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.